You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello, and welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with a special guest. I got my buddy, my blogging buddy, Mr. Scott Eric Alt. Scott, you can see on Pathos. He has his own blog at Pathos called To Give a Defense, because he's a convert like me. He's got an MA in English from Southern Illinois University. He entered the church in 2011, so just slightly after me. I entered the church in 1987, but you know, on a geologic time scale, that's really actually pretty fast. So he was a Methodist growing up, atheist for a little bit. We'll hear about his story. Bounced around to some various Protestant denominations for a couple of years, wound up with the Missouri Synod Lutherans, and then became a Catholic. And he started blogging in 2013, and he an English teacher, a member of the League of English Teachers, who can help you with your grammar. You know, sure, chicks, you know, think that it's pretty hot if you're buff and all that stuff, but can a jock write a sonnet? No. And that's where it really pays off in the end. And he can help you with that. So welcome to the show, Scott Eric Alt. Hello.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like we got a bit of a delay.
Hear you barely. Can you hear me? Okay.
You're coming through loud and clear. If there's Danny, if there's some way to turn up the gain on his phone, that would be good.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, hi. How are you? Nice to talk to you. I talked to you a couple of years ago. I was in Cincinnati, and we met.
Hi.
And I liked the cut of your jib when we met. And so I was happy to kind of reconnect with you in the blogging world, and I thought it'd be good to have you on the show today and talk to another convert about life, the universe, and everything. So talk a little bit about your journey into the church. It was a bit of a meandering journey. Hello?
It was a very meandering journey. I probably would have to go back to when I was in graduate school in the 1990s started reading St. Teresa of Avila and St. John of the Cross, and found myself really attracted to that kind of spirituality. And at the same time, thinking, well, gosh, really ashamed that I can't become Catholic because they teach all these strange things.
Okay.
Like the infallibility of the Pope and purgatory and all that. So there was an attraction to the church, but there was also a distance from it as well on a theological perspective. And it really took a long time of going through one denomination after another and feeling that something was missing, not quite knowing what that was, until I got to the point where I decided that I really needed to look into the arguments for all of those theological teachings that I found that I couldn't accept, find out what the real arguments for them were. And once I did that, I noticed that one teaching after another started to make sense to me, and I was ready to make the leap.
Okay. That would have taken you, well, golly, I mean, if you're starting to read John and Teresa of Avila in the late 90s, that basically took you the last decade or so?
It took me about 15 to 20 years, I would say, yeah.
Yeah, well, and it does that, you know. I mean, there's that sort of long ruminative. There are people who have, you know, the sudden lightning conversions, you know, the kind of the Damascus Road thing happen. But even with St. Paul, if you read the text carefully, you know, when Jesus speaks to St. Paul, he says, it's hard for you to kick against the goads. And you get the sense that is a remark on a long period of internal struggle that you don't get the interior psychology. What you see is just a sudden change in Paul there on the Damascus Road. And so I think even sudden conversions often are you're kind of looking at the tip of an iceberg. So,
yeah, that was very true for me. Once the scales started falling from my eyes, it did seem like the transformation happened pretty quickly. But behind that, there was a long period where God was softening my heart and opening me up to be open-minded to looking into what the Catholic Church had to say, whereas I might not have otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's perfectly legitimate. I mean, I run into sometimes people who don't seem to grasp the psychology of what it takes to undergo a conversion. You know, they'll go, well, here, I showed you this thing. Why aren't you a Catholic now? It's like, well, it doesn't happen that fast. It just, there's a lot of tumblers that have to turn over and things that have to fall into place and, you know, adjustments that need to be made. And it's just not that easy. I've seen people who just seem to me to be remarkably uncomprehending about the kind of struggle that a convert goes through. And it's one of the reasons that I think that prayer is so important, because so much interior work is going on in a person's heart. And we just don't know their story. In addition to, like, doctrinal issues, were there other things that were an obstacle for you?
There were. Mary was a big one for me. And I think I eventually got to the point where I realized what the disconnect with Mary was. It was an emotional one. Imagine, if you will, someone who grew up never knowing who their mother was. And eventually they meet the person who is their biological mother. And they can accept that intellectually, but because they've not had a relationship with their mother for all those years, there's going to be an emotional distance from this person that you wouldn't otherwise have had.
Yeah.
And I didn't see that at first. I had accepted a lot of the theological teachings about Mary, but I felt that there was a distance from her. I couldn't emotionally connect with her. And I'd have to go back a couple of years prior to that to an experience, probably the worst experience in my life. I lost my daughter, who was stillborn. And while I was becoming Catholic, after that, my wife and I got divorced. And it was a few years after that I started journeying towards the Catholic Church. And she and I were talking on the phone one night about my conversion. And she challenged me about Mary. Probably the last thing in the world that I needed to be challenged by at that moment, because that was the one thing I was still struggling with. And she said, Catholics pray to Mary, don't they? And my answer was, well, no, they don't pray to Mary. we ask her to pray for us. And she, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
Okay.
We
That's a weird connection.
We ask her to pray for us, and you talk to Caitlin, don't you? Caitlin's our daughter. And she said, well, yeah, I talked to her, but I don't go to her to ask her for things. And I go to Jesus for that. And I asked her, well, why is it that when Tyler was in his car accident and he ended up okay, he said, thank you, Caitlin. Tyler's her other child. And the conversation didn't go very well after that. I knew she was still struggling with being able to cope with our daughter's death.
Yeah.
And I said to her at one point, you know, it might not hurt you to start talking to Mary. Because after all, Mary lost her child too. And she didn't take well to that, and the conversation ended. But once I got off the phone, I realized that I had said something that I needed to hear as well. Mary lost her child too.
Wow.
And that really started to open up my heart to a relationship with someone who understood what I was going through.
Okay. We're up against a break. Scott, we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Scott Eric Ault, and we'll be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Hello, and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Scott Eric Ault. Scott Eric Ault is a convert. He's a friend of mine, comrade in arms on Facebook, Fighting the Good Fight, Faith and Common Sense and Human Decency, at his blog, To Give a Defense. And that's kind of what you do on your blog, is give you a defense of the faith and common sense against just kind of amazing things that are going on in our world and in our church these days. You said something. Well, I want to finish your story. We'll get to that eventually. But you mentioned before the break, you lost your sweet baby. She was stillborn. And you realized that Mary lost her child. And that was a real point of connection for you. What changed after that? There? We lose Scott?
Two things changed after that. One is that I started to become a lot more at peace with what had happened. The other big thing that changed. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Oh, okay. I thought we'd lost our connection.
Well, I became a lot more at peace with what had happened. I was still struggling with sorrow over that and personal guilt. I actually blamed myself.
Really?
What had happened. I found myself saying, well, you know, God took David's child because of his sin, so therefore he took mine.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Of course, that's a false way of looking at something like that.
Right. Oh, what a terrible burden.
I do remember the other thing that I wanted to say change, okay. I found myself a lot more forgiving towards my ex-wife and a family member of hers than I had been before. I could pray the rosary a lot more easily after this realization about Mary. And it was by praying the rosary specifically for my ex-wife and for family members of hers that I found myself letting go of a lot of things that I continued to hold them accountable for that I really shouldn't have been holding them accountable for.
Okay. Okay. Well, wow. Yeah. That temptation to blame yourself that, you know, somehow or other, this is my fault and that sort of thing, you know, yeah. One of the things that I really, it hit me. I wrote a book about Mary a couple of years ago called Mary, Mother of the Son. And part of that dealt with the rosary because the rosary is kind of the 800-pound gorilla of, you know, Catholic devotion. And when I got to the mystery of, especially to the sorrowful mysteries, and the mystery of the crucifixion, what you're doing in the rosary is you're walking through the life of Jesus, but you're walking through the life of Jesus alongside of his greatest disciple, Mary. And so you're experiencing the passion of Jesus, but you're experiencing it through Mary's eyes. And one of the things that really hit me about the crucifixion was that there's the prophecy that's given to Mary that a sword will pierce your heart as well. That she's told that her son will be for the falling and rising of many in Israel, and a sword will pierce your soul as well, Mary is told when he's still an infant. And when you get to the story of the Passion, somebody pointed out to me once that the last wound that Christ received, it dawned on me, was not something that he experienced because he was already dead. That when his heart is pierced, the reason his heart is pierced is to check and see that he's dead. And he was. And so that sword that pierces his heart, that's what pierces Mary's soul because she has to watch that. And the whole thing about the crucifixion, you know, as you experienced, you know, when your child dies, you would do anything to take their place, anything rather than they have to go through that. And you hear these horrible stories of, you know, parents who, you know, are try to save their children and can't do it. And that's what Mary went through, that the Jesus's part in the crucifixion was to hang on the cross. And Mary's part in the crucifixion was not to hang on the cross. She couldn't do it. She couldn't do it for him. And she would have. And that kind of shared suffering is something that I'm so grateful to the faith for, that as a parent, because there have been times when my children have suffered where I can't take their place. I can't go through what they're going through. And Mary is there as the one who experiences that kind of suffering as a mother, as I have experienced it from my kids as a father. That frustrated inability to endure in my child's place, if I could, the pain that they're going through. And I'm grateful to her for that.
Yeah, and that suffering you describe is also felt by David when Jonathan died.
Yes.
And he says, Jonathan, my son, would that I had died in your place.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I always, that mystery of the rosary has always been especially powerful for me. That moment where she can't, that her place is to not take his place. Thank you, Mary, for doing that for us, you know. Wow. It's a strange gift, but you're right. It is. There's something consoling about it, you know, that because there have to there, you know, when your child suffers like that, you wind up asking all those questions. Is this happening because of something that I did? Or, you know, is this happening because God is capricious and cruel, or, you know, all those kinds of things go through your mind. And what the story of Mary does for us is it reminds us that now God loves you. God stands with the suffering soul, that he is with those who are crushed in spirit, and that he's part of that pain that we go through, and he's not experimenting on us or doing weird things or punishing us and not telling us why, and, you know, all of those, all the rest.
Well, I realized through that experience too that the question why, when confronted with suffering, is really a nonsense question. You don't want to know why. You want the suffering to go away. If God had came down and told me exactly why my daughter died, that's not what I want. I don't want to know why. I just want her back.
Right.
And one of the mysteries of suffering is that God doesn't tell us why. He suffers with us.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it really is. It's the mystery of the cross, you know. I've come through periods of suffering in my life, and there have been times where it's changed me, and I've found light at the end. A lot of I can't think of a time where the why question has been helpful. and sometimes it's been, I've been helping somebody else through it. But I don't understand it. It's a mystery. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Scott Eric Ault, and we will be back on Breadbox Media in just a moment.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Scott Eric Ault. Scott Eric Ault is a convert. That's what we've been discussing the past half hour. He's also the author of the Pathos blog, To Give a Defense. He lives. I'm sorry, I'm blanking out again. Where are you living these days?
I live in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Ah, okay. Out in Indiana, out there in the flatlands. I live in the glorious mountainous, it's like the Swiss Alps, really. It's really a paradise on earth, Seattle. But, you know, I'm sure that Fort Wayne has its charms as well. and anyway, Scott, we've been talking about Scott's conversion. Scott's had kind of another sort of conversion in the last year, as have I, frankly. Scott wrote something a few months back as we watched the unspooling horror of the not merely of the Trump campaign come to be the dominant political force in the United States, to my astonishment and everlasting horror, but also as I watched Christians who initially said, oh, poo, there's nothing to the guy, to saying, you know, well, he's a terrible choice, but I'll support anybody else but him, to saying he's our candidate and I'll support him even though he's not all that good because Hillary's worse, to now we've arrived at the point where every day I'm listening to Christians saying he is our president and I will support him no matter what. Everything that he does is fantastic. And about, I don't know, 6 months or so ago, Scott made the remark to somebody that I've never forgotten. He said, for years, liberals came to me and said, you guys are racist. And Scott said, that's not what we're about. And he meant it with all his heart. And I totally empathize because I always said the same thing. Ah, that's not true. You're just making stuff up. That's not what we're about. And about 6 months ago, he began to realize that he was now saying to his fellow conservatives, that's not what we're about. And to his astonishment and to mine, he was discovering, yeah, that actually is a lot of what we're about. Trump's campaign was built and remains built on a thoroughly racist foundation and also a misogynist foundation. And these things were features, not bugs, for his supporters. And Scott and I have both gone through the past year just with our mouths hanging open, looking at the spectacle of conservative Christians who have gone from saying, you know, no, I don't support him, to supporting everything that this guy does. And you wrote a piece today that, you know, once again sort of highlights just the bizarreness of the of what the Christian right in this country has become. I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit, Scott. After our weird time.
I'm at a loss to explain it. I'm really at a loss to explain it. I don't know whether or not the percentage of racists, sexists, bigots in the Republican Party is greater than it used to be, or whether it's that though that element in the Republican Party has come to the forefront with Trump's ascendancy and the ascendancy of the alt-right, and now they find themselves almost reflexively obliged to defend it because they don't want to cede power to the other side, which they perceive as advancing abortion and advancing same-sex marriage and other things that they find abhorrent. As well they should, but to defend things that are equally abhorrent in order to avoid those things doesn't do them very much credit in the end. And it ends up simply advancing 100% of evils rather than 50% of evils.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the thing that has continually shocked me. Russell Moore, he's a Southern Baptist, gave a talk. First Things gave him some award or other, and he gave a speech. I think it was called Can the Religious Right Survive? And in the course of it, he throws out a line which has stuck with me. He says, the religious right are now the people the religious right warned you about 20 years ago. And that's the weird thing to me, is that the religious right has adopted as its foundational philosophy and core rhetorical strategies all the things that it said were wrong with the left 20 years ago. So its reflexive reply to every charge of supporting evil is, well, they do it too. Obama did it. So, you know, you've remarked on this a couple of times. Trump will do something, and the way it's always defended is, well, Obama did this. And it's like, how did Obama go from being the worst president in history, according to the right, to our model for all things that we will now do? And that's weird, you know, is the sort of no use, or the, you know, the tu quoque fallacy is the first thing that's constantly appealed to. And the other thing that is constantly appealed to is the genetic fallacy. Things are true or false, not according to whether they're true or false, but according to who said them. So Trump said it, therefore it's true, even if it's an obvious lie. It's like here's a photograph. Trump says something about this photograph that is patently false. You can see it with your own two eyes. The response is, well, Trump says this, so it's true. And it's like, seriously? And, you know, conversely, something that's obviously true is denied, not because it's false, but because of who said it. This is published on the wrong website. This is said by the wrong person. You're going to listen to that guy. He's a member of such and such a website. This way of thinking is just death. It's become the standard way in which Christian conservatives talk and think all the time. I am gobsmacked by it, but I'm seeing it every single day. And I don't know what to do about it.
Sorry, it's hard to know what to do about it. Back during the campaign, I remember coming up with a line that I would always use when people would insist that Trump really is pro-life. And you would challenge them. How do you know that he's pro-life? What kind of a pro-life record does he actually have? Well, he says he is. So my way of addressing that was simply to say, so Trump said it, I believe it, that settles. Which is a play on a bumper sticker that you used to see a lot of. The Bible says it, I believe it, that settles.
Right.
And people would object to that. Well, no, you're trying to say that I'm treating Trump like he's some sort of deity or God, and no, that's not the case at all. And yet, just this past week, I think, within the past 7 days, Ann Coulter tweeted that Trump is now the head of church. And you find those very same people defending Ann Coulter's words.
Right. Ann Coulter, who wrote a book called In Trump We Trust. I mean, come on, you know? And And Trump's obvious strategy, and this is the strategy that's obviously something that Steve Bannon is behind, is to try as hard as he can to – well, he said in a tweet earlier this week that the media, all media, everywhere are, quote, the enemies of the people. That is language that has a very dark pedigree. This is the language that was used by, you know, Mao, Stalin, Hitler used similar kinds of language, referring to the lying press. Well, we're up against a break, but we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Mr. Scott Eric Ault, and we will be back in just a minute talking a bit more about our life as Catholics in a very screwy time in American history. We'll be back on Redbox Media right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Scott Eric Ault on extreme time delay telephone. There's some kind of weird thing going on in the stratosphere or something as the signal bounces off of Neptune and then makes it through a satellite and somehow gets back here. So we're actually speaking to Scott from he's in Fort Wayne, Indiana, but it kind of sounds like he must be speaking to us from the South Pole via a mysterious time delay. So that's why there are these peculiar gaps in our conversation. It's not that Scott is deaf or has trouble understanding English. It's just technology problems. But you wrote a piece today. For those who are not familiar with him, there's basically a paid professional bomb thrower for the alt-right, a guy named Milo Yiannopoulos. The alt-right, for those unfamiliar with the term, is essentially it is a group of largely internet-based white supremacist, racist, you know, white race theorists and so forth, KKK neo-Nazi types who have got all kinds of theories about the supremacy of the white race and so on and so forth. Nobody ever heard of them until, unfortunately, they suddenly reached political ascendancy because the guy who created a platform for them, a guy named Steve Bannon, who used to run Breitbart, which is a web aggregator site for alt-right crap, is now in the White House as the right-hand man to Donald Trump. And so these lunatics who live under rocks and logs are now, improbably, major political powers in the land. And one of their darlings is an English guy. He is gay. Let's see. Says he's Jewish. Also says he's Catholic. Racist. Likes to write anti-Semitic garbage. And he has been throwing bombs on the internet for, I don't know, several years now, right? Four or five years, maybe. I'm not really clear. Anyway, The big news. So he wound up getting a book contract with Simon and Schuster because he was like a noise, and so they thought, well, here's some money that we can make. So they signed this contract with him, and he was going to write some book full of incendiary stuff because that's what he does, is write incendiary stuff. And then he got invited to CPAC, which is basically the conservative soiree where conservatives get together in their natural habitat and drink beer and talk about conservative things. So he was invited to be like a keynote speaker at this thing. And then some news came out this week that he had, and there was tape recordings and so on of him, saying warm and affirming things about the goodness of pedophilia and pederasty and all the rest of it. So CPAC showed that even as shameless and disgusting as they are, even they could finally respond to some faint flicker of conscience, and they uninvited him. And then Simon and Schuster dumped him from their book contract and said, never mind. And then today, Breitbart also dumped him. Actually, no, they didn't dump him. He resigned, to his credit. In a rare move, he did something that Trump has never, ever done in his entire life. He took responsibility for things that he'd said and resigned. And good for him for doing that. And then pro-life Christian leaders started arguing on his behalf. And I'll just leave it to you from here. Scott, you commented on this.
Well, what I have seen from more than three or four people on Facebook, but not random people. These include Professor Janet Smith, who's a professor of moral theology. This includes Austin Root, actually defending his comments under either the guise that they were misinterpreted or he wasn't really defending pedophilia or pederasty at all.
Okay.
And please to go and actually read the transcript, which I did, and he actually does defend pedophilia and pederasty. He comes out right out and says, yes, I am defending it. So it's hard to know what is motivating them to make these kinds of defenses other than to say, well, he's a conservative, so I'm obligated to defend the conservative because we can't let the liberals have a victory over
right.
us.
Yeah, that appears to be the rationale. And unfortunately, that happens a lot. Yeah. And it's appalling. Getting back to Russell Moore's remarks, one of the things that Russell Moore said is that the great blunder that Christians have made in the last 20 years, conservative Christians have made in the last 20 years, is they have stopped measuring the actions of conservatives against the gospel and have begun to solely measure them against their culture war enemies. And I would add the worst imagined versions of their culture war enemies. And so as long as whatever it is they're defending isn't as terrible as their culture war enemy, then it's fine. And so you get these insane defenses of stuff like Milo Yiannopoulos, because he's one of our guys in their thought. You know, he makes the liberals mad, and, you know, he's really good at that.
And so we're going to just go ahead and keep defending him because he's one of our guys. And it's like, what are you doing? And what are pro-lifers doing involving themselves in this? Why is this a pro-life thing at all? You know, what I've heard a million times is our core non-negotiable goal, the five non-negotiables, that's what we have to focus on, is abortion, euthanasia, gay marriage, embryonic stem cell research, and human cloning. That's what our focus is supposed to be, and we can't get distracted by anything else. And then I turn around, and the next minute, there's Austin Roos and Janet Smith frittering their time away defending a guy who was on putting himself on record defending pedophilia. Why? What good is this doing?
It makes no sense to me. The whole point of the non-negotiables, and there are actually more than five of them, there are nine of them, and social justice is one of them. But I wrote a whole blog article on that several months back. But the whole setup for it is the non-negotiables are things that offend against the dignity of the human person. I can't imagine very much that offends more greatly against the dignity of the human person than pedophilia, which is a violation that I can't, the dignity of the human person, I can't even imagine.
Mm-hmm. I know. It's just mind-numbing.
You get the butt abortion defense a lot if they can theorize that, well, nothing is worse than abortion. Nothing is worse than the slaughter of 60 million babies in the womb. Mm-hmm. And use that as a cover to defend any other violation of human dignity on the theory that, well, abortion is worse, and so we have to accept this in order to not have the worst thing because Trump and the Republicans will end abortion. But then you go and you look at the Supreme Court justices who voted to uphold abortion rights and create abortion rights, and the majority of them are all Republican appointed.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and plus, you know, what also is going on here, of course, is that when Berkeley canceled Yiannopoulos, Trump made noises again on Twitter about possibly cutting funding to Berkeley. And so in doing that, what Trump did was sort of gave his stamp of approval to Yiannopoulos. And what happens over and over again is people who have committed to support Trump now have to support everything that Trump supports. He supports Yiannopoulos. Therefore, we're going to go to bat for Yiannopoulos, no matter, you know, how gross and inexcusable and mission creep this is. Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. My guest today was Scott Eric Ault. You can go and read his work at Pathos at his blog, To Give a Defense. We will be back tomorrow with Mr. Rod Bennett. Our producer today was Danny Head. I was your host, Mark Shea, and we'll be back tomorrow. Until then, have a lovely evening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.